We are Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Honesdale got a rare visitor recently, the president of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank. Leah Mayo of the River Reporter joins us live to tell us why she came, what she said about the economy, and what it means for the community. This weekend, the Borschfeld Historical Marker Project unveils its 14th marker in Parksville, with another to follow later this month in Livingston Manor. More than commemorating the past, these markers bring history alive. We'll speak with the organizers of the project about how they're capturing and sharing the story of the Catskills and the Borschfeld. Arts for Sullivan Grants are open as of today. Tanner Simon from the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance joins us with the details for artists. And he gave us The Twilight Zone and Forever Changed Television. This week, the Rosendale Theater shines a spotlight on Rod Serling. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi has more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is delivering remarks at a rare gathering of top military leaders in Virginia at this hour. Speaking at Quantico, Trump reaffirmed his commitment to service members and pledged to bolster the armed forces.
We're a team, and so my message to you is very simple. I am with you, I support you, and as president, I have your backs 100%. You'll never see me even waver a little bit.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth opened the address with a strong defense of the U.S. military, saying America must be ready for war. Hegseth also criticized diversity initiatives, arguing that past promotions based on identity rather than combat readiness had hurt the force. Military leaders were summoned to Quantico on short notice last week, with many of them traveling from military command posts from around the world. A federal judge has put a stop to the mass layoffs of most of the workforce at the Voice of America and its federal parent, the U.S. Agency for Global Media. NPR's David Folkenflik reports the judge ruled that Trump administration officials are violating the law repeatedly.
The White House and acting agency CEO Carrie Lake have been intent on dismantling Voice of America. Hundreds of journalists there had been on indefinite paid leave for months before the layoffs started. Senior U.S. District Court Judge Royce Lamberth is pausing them for now. For the moment, Lamberth is demanding that officials show how they are meeting Congress's requirement that Voice of America serve as a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. He noted the network was not running radio programming in many languages despite legal requirements. Lamberth questioned Lake's integrity and competence, calling the administration's conduct egregious. Lake has previously and repeatedly accused the judge of trying to run Voice of America from the bench. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street opened mixed this morning as the federal government moves toward a possible shutdown at midnight. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow rose about 28 points in early trading.
Investors have largely shrugged off the possibility that many government functions will be temporarily halted overnight unless lawmakers can reach a stopgap funding agreement. The economic fallout from previous shutdowns has been limited, although the costs start to pile up the longer a shutdown drags on. The Trump administration has also threatened large-scale layoffs of government workers, which could cause more lasting effects. The federal government's already cut about 100,000 workers this year. The Labor Department is scheduled to issue its monthly jobs report on Friday, but that won't happen if the government's number-crunching bureau is temporarily shut down. A lengthy shutdown could also delay the upcoming inflation report. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks continue to trade mixed on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow up 46 points, the Nasdaq Composite down 51. This is NPR News. Communities across the United States and Canada are marking Orange Shirt Day today. It's an annual day of remembrance for the attendees of Indian boarding schools which attempted to forcibly assimilate Native children in the 18 and 1900s. NPR's Caden Mills reports.
People across the country will don their orange shirts to honor the Native children who attended Indian boarding schools, who were often subjected to abuse and forbidden to speak their languages. The University of Minnesota Morris sits on the grounds of a former federal Indian boarding school.
This was a genocide. We survived. We are resilient.
21-year-old Nani Makakuman is a student leader at Morris. She's Menominee and Winnebago.
Honoring them is a way for us to heal and to help us understand what our parents, grandparents, all our relatives went through.
The orange shirts, they honor one Canadian survivor whose new orange shirt was taken on her first day of school in 1973. Caden Mills, NPR News.
Prosecutors in New York are urging a federal judge to sentence music mogul Sean Diddy Combs to more than 11 years in prison. They filed their sentencing recommendation this morning, along with letters from some of his accusers. Combs has remained jailed since he was convicted on prostitution-related charges back in July. On Wall Street, the Dow up 64 points at this hour, the Nasdaq down 35, the S&P down 2 points. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Now we're joined by Leah Mayo of the River Reporter to discuss a high-profile visit to Honesdale, the president of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank. Liam is here to tell us about the key takeaways of her visit and what it could mean for the local economy. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
So why is this a big deal? And can you provide an overview of the event where the president, when the president of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank visited Honesdale, what was the primary purpose of her visit?
So this was Anna Paulson, who joined the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia on July 1 as the new president. The Federal Reserve banks are this series of 12 banks across the country that collectively set monetary policy for the country. And they have a couple of roles beyond that as well, some of which are community development and sort of convening discussions in communities around their in their sphere of influence to solve community problems, as well as communicating with people about the state of the economy. So Paulson was visiting Honesdale as part of one of like a fact-finding mission to really get an on-the-ground sense of what the economy was doing like, or how the local economy is doing. And she said that that helps the work she does with the Federal Reserve for a couple of reasons. She said that a lot of the economic data and statistics that she has access to are more backwards-looking than forwards-looking. Like, they're numbers and data that someone has collected about things that have already happened, and it's harder to project that into the future. Whereas if you're sort of on the ground talking to local business owners, those local business owners are needing to look like 6 months, a year, however long ahead to plan what they're doing for their businesses. So by sort of visiting out in the field like she was doing, you can actually get a really good sense for where the economy is going. And she also said that it helps her better understand and better communicate about the state of the economy. She said, quote, "I don't want to tell you 17 statistics. I want to tell you a story that has real people involved."
And you were there. Paulson spoke to the River Reporter. Let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say.
And then I think another component of what I do in this job is communicate about what's going on in the economy to people. And for that, it's a lot better to have examples and real people that folks can relate to. And also it just helps it come alive for myself, too. Like, I don't want to, you know, tell you 17 statistics. I want to tell you a story that has real people involved.
And that's the president of the Federal Reserve, Anna Paulson, who was in Honesdale, speaking to the River Reporter. Liam, Paulson visited several Main Street businesses over the course of her visit. Tell us about the reaction in the community.
Yeah. So the part of the visit I was there for, she was visiting a couple of specific Main Street businesses. She talked with the owner of Greenhouse 863, a coffee shop on Main Street, and Gather, a boutique on Main Street. And what kind of stood out as a major topic of discussion was difficulties in the housing market and the effect that has on businesses. Business owners said that the expensive housing both makes it difficult to, like, attract workers and to find quality workers, but also sort of redefines the definition of success they have for their own businesses. The owner of Gather, Olivia Santos, said that her success in her business, she defined that as sort of being able to make enough money to buy a house. But then with the rising cost of housing in Wayne County, she had to kind of stretch that timeline out a bit. It took her longer to find success in her business because the success.
That's really exciting. That's really exciting. I mean, it looks gorgeous.
And so the things that people in the businesses on Main Street were talking about were just, you know, really hitting their pocket and hitting them close to home. What did the president share about the current economic landscape and anything that could particularly impact rural communities like Honesdale?
She said that there was less about sort of the current economic status of the country. Like, she was saying that she was sort of there to find out what was going on in the economy and sort of what could impact things. There was some discussion from local business owners about, like, the impacts of tariffs, with the owner of Greenhouse saying that she already kind of had slim margins on certain things, but then the rising prices of coffee sort of cut into the margins on that, and the impact of tariffs cut into the margins of the, like, of the gift store stuff that she was selling. So the only thing she was making money on anymore were, like, the vintage clothes she was selling or the plants she was selling, like, other minor parts of the business. And then just another couple points on housing. Business owners said as well that the poor quality of housing in the area was really affecting them, where even if they wanted to, like, find housing or renovate housing for workers, it was just really too expensive to figure out. So not only would you need to lay out a lot of money to buy a house, you would also need to lay out significantly more money to renovate that house. So the owner of Gather, who was sort of went into business looking to buy a house, eventually just ended up needing to build a house from scratch because there just weren't available options that were better.
You have a interview with her too. That is the owner of Gather there on Main Street, a boutique selling women's clothes, home decor, and gifts for adults, kids, and babies. Olivia Santo. Here she is speaking to the River Reporter.
That's really exciting. I mean, it looks gorgeous, but I think it's. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's what you see physically, but mm-hmm. the conversation that we had at the Cooperage, right? Like, there's so many people who are invested in the success of this community. Mm-hmm. Who are well aware of its challenges, but mm-hmm. are really working together to solve them. It's really fascinating.
And she's striking a very positive note about Honesdale and Honesdale's community coming together, business community at least, feeling that there's a bright future for businesses and Main Street in that community.
Yeah, that quote was actually from Anna Paulson, who was.
It was mislabeled there. Sorry about
No, that's my fault for not labeling it more clearly. But no, that was something Paulson sort of emphasized in all of the conversations she had. We asked, like, you know, what were some takeaways from Honesdale specifically? And some of her takeaways were, like, yes, this community has issues. Like, their housing was sort of the main one that bubbled up, but, like, you know, there are issues in every community everywhere across the country. But one of the things that made Honesdale stand out was there was this really strong network of community groups and business owners and local leadership that was standing up to help resolve those issues and working really closely together on trying to make the community better. So there was a lot of positivity in the visit about the future of Honesdale, and not just from a, like, small business perspective, which was sort of part of the focus of it, but also just as a community on the rise.
Well, and it's probably even more impactful to have the president of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve Bank say those things about your community, even if she's visiting there for just a couple of hours and sensing that there is some good momentum going on in the community. But that's echoed by the businesses themselves, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Both of these business owners who she talked to were people who had moved to the community, one who'd moved there from elsewhere, one who'd moved back to the community, sort of because of the vibrancy and because things were starting to happen and then have become themselves part of continuing this vibrancy and continuing things. But what you said about, you know, it means more when it comes from sort of such an expert as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, that's, I think, absolutely true. Like, if you were just, like, going about in Wayne County, there is a lot of discussion about the collaboration and a lot of interest in really working closely together with people. But it's, you know, I think it means something different when it's someone coming in from the outside and saying, like, oh, I identify this here. I, like, see this happening here in comparison to sort of the other places I've been visiting, or just in comparison to some of the other places around the country, versus just saying, like, versus just having it come from within the community. So having someone with that broader perspective also identify that as a strength, I think, was a really cool element of her visit.
And, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank, as you said in the beginning, the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia is one of 12 banks across the United States that collectively set the monetary policy and ensure the stability of our financial system in the country. Paulson oversees the Philadelphia Fed, which covers Delaware, southern New Jersey, and eastern PA. So do you think that, you know, when you think about this, it seems rather dense in some ways, but when she's there on the ground on Main Street, and just from your personal observation as well, do you think this influences the local community's perception of the Federal Reserve and its policies in some ways?
I think potentially, yeah. I think the, you know, this on the ground visit, one of the stated impressions of it is to connect what's happening on the local level to what's happening kind of on the federal level. And from Paulson's perspective, that's like bringing learnings from the local level up into the federal level. But I think you're right. And it does work the other way as well, where, like, you know, the financial system, capital S system is like a big, broad thing that sometimes feels like it happens very far away, whereas this kind of visit really connects everything really closely. One of the things Paulson said was that, quote, being here, seeing what's really happening on the ground is super important to me, to kind of connect what's happening on Main Street, like literally Main Street here, with what happens on Wall Street or what happens around the Federal Open Market Committee table. So, again, I think that happened for her, but it also does happen for people on the local level, seeing that person and that connection between those two very different levels of the economy.
That's Leah Mayo, news editor of the River Reporter. His report on the visit of the Philadelphia Reserve Bank's president to Honesdale is in the current issue at riverreporter.com or on newsstands. You can read his reporting and all of the great team's work there. Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, this weekend, the Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project is dedicating its 14th marker in Parksville, followed later this month by one in Livingston Manor. Coming up, I'll speak with photographer, historian, and curator Marissa Scheinfeld and photographer Isaac Jeffries about how these markers preserve the Catskills legacy and what they reveal about the Borscht Belt era. That's coming up after a break. It's Radio Chatskill.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, reminding you to join me and my friends for Laura Flanders and Friends on Radio Catskill Monday evenings at 7, followed by Sabrina Artel's Trailer Talk. And then, starting October 6th, we welcome the Janice Adams Show to its new night at 8, followed by La Voz en Breve with Mariel Fiore. Four powerhouse shows back-to-back, local voices bringing world-class conversations about what's really happening in our lives. Monday evenings on Radio Catskill.
On the next Radiolab.
So I began writing the poem.
What does it take to write a poem that will travel into outer space?
I was trying to imagine
all the way to one of Jupiter's moons.
Whether there were other beings out there, whether the audience was the stars themselves. I kept imagining a loneliness.
That's on the next Radiolab. Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Catskills were once the heart of the Borscht Belt when towns like Parksville and Livingston Manor bustled with resorts, entertainers, and families seeking a summer escape. This weekend, the Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project unveils its 14th marker in Parksville and another one's following later this month in Livingston Manor. More than commemorating the past, these markers bring history alive through art and music, food and film. Joining me now, photographer, historian and curator Marissa Scheinfeld, along with photographer Isaac Jeffries, who are helping capture and share the story of the Catskills and the Borscht Belt through this historical marker project. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Marissa, the Parksville Marker recognizes how the O&W Railroad transformed the farming town into this bustling resort hub. Why was Parksville such an important place in Borscht Belt history?
Well, Parksville, just like so many other towns, had an immense Borscht Belt history. It, you know, had the Young's Gap Hotel, all-inclusive, the first all-inclusive year-round resort. It offered unbelievable amenities. There was an iconic film screen there in 1950. It hosted, like, amazing entertainers and, you know, just had everything. I think we have, like, 28 hotels in Parksville is our count. So it has a true history that we're excited to celebrate.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Young's Gap. The Young's Gap Hotel was a pioneer with that all-inclusive year-round model, even featured in the film Catskill Honeymoon. What stands out to you about that hotel's legacy in particular? Isaac or Marissa?
Yeah, sorry. I'd say, honestly, the Young's Gap, I mean, for me, yeah, all-inclusive. Marissa really nailed it. Like, they had their own radio show, which is something pretty cool. I mean, it was part of like WVOS. We have a photo of it from the 1940s where they were, I think, hosting, I believe it was like Max Schwartz Company or something, talking about like brochures for the season. So like they really had their own sort of compound going on there. But then right down the road, you had like the New Brighton Hotel and the Grand Hotel, Clients Hillside, kind of smaller resorts. But the Young's Gap was one of the big anchor resorts in the county, I'd say. It could go up there with the Laurels and Grossinger's and the Neverly. It just kind of dropped off, you know, in the late 60s. So that's why it doesn't really get remembered as much. But it's one of the big ones.
The marker that's being installed in Parksville this weekend also mentions Sunset Acres. That was an African-American resort in Parksville. Why is it important to highlight those stories? And tell us more about Sunset Acres, Marissa.
Sure. Yeah. You know, obviously this project is rooted in Jewish history and everything that happened in the Borscht Belt. But when you really look at its history, it blends so many other groups' history. And the African-American community had multiple hotels in the area. About a handful. And Sunset Acres, actually, Isaac, I have to give Isaac all the credit to that. He discovered that and I'll let him tell you how. But it's the ruins of it are there.
Isaac, tell us a little bit more about, you know, coming across this hotel resort in Parksville.
Yeah, I mean, I was, I had heard about this hotel once before, you know, seeing like an eBay listing for a brochure probably 4 or 5 years ago. And then one day I was going through Parksville, I veered off onto Benton Hollow Road, which is now basically covered up by Route 17 when they did the expansion a few years ago. And this property is just sitting there, which looks a lot like a Borscht Belt hotel, but I couldn't find really any information on it. And then, lo and behold, one day at Town & Country Antiques in Liberty, which is also an amazing store that is still open, I found a stack of unposted postcards from Sunset Acres. And only one image was shown. It's just a poolside photo of people lounging by the pool with the main building in the background. But to find like a full color 1960s postcard from this place, you know, so close to where it was really special. And I think we kind of brought it out of obscurity, which I think is pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that this project is doing a lot of and helping bring these stories back to life. The Parksville dedication this weekend includes a lot of things, music, food, film screening. Tell us more about what's going on at the ceremony this weekend, Marissa.
Sure. So we're going to have John Conway speaking at the ceremony. We have some hotel descendants. That'll be at 2:00 at the intersection of Parksville Road and Short Avenue. And then we will move down the street to New Memories, Conflux Gallery, Art Collective, and Double Up. And we're partnering with the Parksville Art Center, and we're doing something called Meet Me in Parksville. It's going to be a continuation, festivities, live music, celebrating the essence of the Borscht Belt. We're going to have wine and cider served. There's going to be food available from Double Up to purchase. And in the background, we're doing a special screening of that film, Catskill Honeymoon, which was filmed at the Young's Gap. And it's a real time capsule period piece. It has classic Catskill scenes, golf and tennis and calisthenics and sunbathers. And we're really thrilled. It's just going to be a lovely afternoon to celebrate not only Parksville's history, but what's going on in Parksville today.
How do you balance celebrating the vibrant resort era, but you're also acknowledging the decline of these communities, but this is bringing them back, right? This is how you're trying to do that?
I think in some ways... Yeah, sorry, Marissa, I don't mean to cut you off.
No, you go, Isaac.
In some ways, it's almost like, and it's going to sound intense when I say this, but it's almost like a eulogy, like a proper eulogy for the hotels that existed there once, but now, no longer exist there. That being said, it's also, we don't want to just spend our time talking about what once was and saying, it used to be great, now it's not great anymore. When the reality is a lot of these places are, they're going through change. Change is constant. It's part of life. So Parksville, though it may be a little bit slower in its change, is not showing signs of moving forward. I think it's actually a really vibrant place, and that's why we're so excited to do this event with, especially with Double Up and New Memories. I mean, it's like a whole new life has been breathed into the town, and you can really feel it starting to kind of take shape now. So, I think it's a little bit of the past and the present and celebrating both at the same time while, touching on all aspects of the history.
I think eulogy is a really appropriate way to say that, because these places didn't necessarily get that tribute, right? They sort of just faded away. And this is a great way of bringing them back to life, sharing their memories, and then also celebrating what's new there, too. So it really is a great way that you guys are bringing it together. And then beyond Parksville, later this month, the project is dedicating that marker in Livingston Manor. Livingston Manor had beaucoup hotels, 40 hotels at least, and a unique culture of its own. What do you think made Livingston Manor different from other Borscht Belt communities? Marissa?
Livingston Manor was really unique in the sense that it offered resorts for young people, specifically singles and couples. There were other Catskill resorts that did offer that, but particularly two hotels in Livingston Manor, White Row and the Waldemere. So we're going to be honoring those. Like you said, 41 hotels, 12 bungalow colonies. So such a tremendous history. And it really is the northern part of the Borscht Belt. Some people probably never ventured up there in its heyday, but those that did know it well. The marker also highlights tumblers, which were like entertainers and MCs. So we have people like Danny Kaye, Mel Brooks, Lenny Bruce on the marker. And of course, highlighting other hotels and histories. We're going to have Judy Siegel there, whose family ran the Edgewood Inn. We're going to have a descendant from the White Row who's coming. And Paula Kaye will be speaking there. And we're just really excited about that one.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the tumblers and their impact and how they contributed not only to the entertainment culture in the Borscht Belt and Livingston Manor, but just on American comedy worldwide, really. Isaac?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's funny because we don't really experience these sort of entertainers nowadays. I mean, the closest thing that we can think of to a tumbler for, kids from the 90s and 2000s would maybe be like Pee Wee Herman or something like that. So it's totally like a reintroduction to an era of entertainment that I don't know if it's going to exist again. I would like it to, but it's really something that I think defined resort culture, especially in the Catskills, because, tumblers were, they would be seen in like the nightclubs, obviously, but I think where they really got their time to shine was by the pool during the day. And, I think it was just they were a real, big part of creating a, thriving, fun sort of, constantly moving atmosphere at these places. And for the tumblers themselves, I mean, like it's mentioned on the marker, a lot of these people are comedians starting out. And this is kind of where they were able to, I guess, test out their material / just kind of get a feel for, how people responded to you know, the things that they said, the way they acted, the way they moved. So, you know, it's kind of, we're paying homage to a really special sort of time that we may have not gotten to experience, but, you know, we can tell it's so near and dear to the people that come to these dedications because they'll talk about these things as if, you know, I mean, the smile and the beams of light that kind of go into these people's faces when they talk about, you know, tumblers and entertainers and stuff like that. It's a real connection. Yeah. So we're happy to be honoring that.
Okay, let's remind folks about these upcoming dedications. The first one in Parksville Sunday and then Livingston Manor coming up October 18th. Marissa, can you tell us where folks can get more information?
Sure. So Livingston Manor, intersection of Main and Pearl, the marker's going to be right in the middle of the town, 2 p.m. We're dedicating it. And at 3:30, Isaac and I are giving an illustrated talk at Catskill Art Space. It's called Wish You Were Here, Tracing the Resort Era in Livingston Manor. And we're really excited. We're going to show like rare archives and film and a little bit of our own publications that we've been working on and everything. Oh, no, sorry. And then we're having an after party at Sunshine Colony.
Great.
So it's a really great lineup. www.maytheborscht.org. You can find everything. And we're also very active on Instagram and Facebook, Borschtfeld Historical Markers.
We have a little more time before we go. Can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming publications that you'll be talking about? Marissa, I'll start with you and then Isaac.
Sure, yeah. So I've been working on a book for about 5 years or so. It looks at hidden and unknown histories, fringe histories, and alternative histories of the Catskills and the Hudson Valley. Not done yet, but really excited and getting close to telling, you know, the stories of what once was and extended beyond just the story of the Borschtfeld that my first book was about. This one kind of looks at the Catskills and the Hudson Valley where I currently live in more of like a universal, like layered experience of many different groups.
And Isaac, could you tell us about what your upcoming project is?
Yeah. TBD, the publisher, but... A book is coming. A photo book is coming. I've been working on my own photos of the Borschtfeld hotels and what remains for the last, I'd say, probably 6 or 7 years. But really kind of honed in on this the last like 2 or 3 years where I go into these places at night, set lights up, and kind of try to give a sort of feeling like it's the 1950s again and, you know, confuse people when they look at the photo. Is it open? Is it closed? But I'm trying to go a little bit deeper beyond just abandoned hotels and find hotels that have turned into summer camps or, you know, rehab centers, anything where, you know, you're going to find like a 50s lobby left over unintentionally that still may be there kind of hidden in plain sight. So it's going to be a pretty extensive thing when it comes out, but more information TBD.
And then any more historical markers that you can let us know about that are upcoming, tease us with anything else?
I don't know if we can announce them yet. Okay. But we definitely, I don't know, can we announce one? We definitely have 5 that we're working on for next summer and fall. Uh-huh. We're working on getting permission for a lot of them, but we're going to be moving all around the terrain, and Isaac said it really well a couple of days ago, like we're digging deeper into the Borschtfeld.
Right.
And not to mention, just as a shout out, we haven't unveiled it just yet, but we have a Pomeroy marker in the ground just outside of Sullivan County in Ellenville overlooking Route 52 where that overlook is. But it's just a general Borschtfeld historic marker, one of the blue and gold ones from New York State. It just kind of defines what the Borschtfeld was. And we have one going on Route 42 in Fallsburg next year, I believe, probably in the spring. Right, Marissa?
Yeah. So the Pomeroys are actually like 2 more historic markers that will, I guess, debut. And so we're really excited. So we got 7 coming.
Yeah, that's great. That's photographer, historian, and curator Marissa Scheinfeld, along with photographer Isaac Jeffries, who are helping capture and share the story of the Borschtfeld through the Borschtfeld Historical Marker Project. They're unveiling their 14th marker in Parksville Sunday, another to follow later this month in Livingston Manor. More information about that at borschtbewithyou.com. And more information about
.org.
Sorry, and more information about Marissa's work at marissascheinfeld.com, and more information about Isaac's works at isaacjeffries.com. Thank you both for preserving this history. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back,
Artists, please pay attention. You could fund your next big art project. Tanner Simon from the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance is sharing how Sullivan County artists can apply for the Arts for Sullivan grants. That's next on Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week on This American Life, when Zoran Mamdani won the primary race for New York mayor a couple months ago, the Democratic establishment didn't exactly embrace him. And it made me think of another charismatic, unconventional candidate years ago who the same thing happened to.
I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago.
Chicago's first black mayor, Harold Washington. How that played out for him this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan County's artists and art organizations have an opportunity to bring their creative projects to life through the Arts for Sullivan grants. It's a program of the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance providing funding and support for local arts initiatives from visual art and performance to community-based projects. These grants help to keep the arts thriving across our region. Joining us now to talk about it, how to apply, and the upcoming information sessions, it's Tanner Simon from the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance, the grants coordinator. Hello.
Hi, Tim. Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to be here in Jeffersonville.
Well, so, we're in Liberty.
So. Liberty, sorry.
Doesn't matter where we are, we can still tell folks about this great countywide Arts for Sullivan Liberty. Grants program. Talk a little bit more about it and the significance that this program has on Sullivan County artists and organizations.
So it's quite an incredible grants program. We are a re-granting organization, so we get money from NISCA, the New York State Council on the Arts, to distribute to the county because we have our fingers on the pulse, so to speak. So we funded over 30 projects this past grant cycle and distributed 6 individual artist fellowships, which is quite incredible. So that's about $82,000 in total of re-granting from NISCA. So the 6 individual artist fellowships encompass compositional arts, literary arts, and visual arts, and there are 2 fellowships available in each category. So last year, each grant was $3,000. However, this year, it is $5,000.
Wow, great.
The amount has gone up quite a bit, which is incredible because it's unrestricted money for the artist to make art, to live and make art, to travel to an artist residency. It's very impactful. Artists have made music videos. They have hunkered down in their studios and just made work. There's such a wide range of things to do. So luckily, that deadline is a little bit farther out. So all the grant programs are opening up on October 15th, but that one has until January 31st to submit. So there's plenty of time to reach out and talk about the project with me to make sure, because there is a community engagement activity with all of the individual artist fellowships. They have to do some kind of exhibition or performance or public outreach to involve the community so people can kind of experience and get impacted by the artwork that they're producing.
So let's talk about some of the opportunities that are available. You mentioned that there's more money. How do applicants determine the appropriate grant category for their projects?
So there are a couple in terms of individual artist fellowships. The literary art is for poets and writers. The compositional art would be for musicians or perhaps choreographers or theaters. And then we have visual art, which could be for photography, painting, sculpture, performance. These 3 categories, typically we can fit everybody into something. And mm-hmm. if there's a question, we work with people to find the best fit for them. So it's great that we can offer, 6 fellowships like that. It's quite incredible. Yeah. And for community arts, that grant program is for arts organizations. So, for example, the Calicoon Business Association gets funded for the Calicoon Art Walk, which is coming up. That's a project that a lot of people know about, and it's very exciting. So the Bethel Lakeside Development Corp for Bethel Lakeside Music, It's another one of our grantees, Too Short to Suck Film Festival in Parksville.
Which we featured here.
Yeah, and it also came again, and we did a second screening at the Big Eddie Film Festival this past weekend, which was great to have everybody come out again for that. And then, of course, the Wurtsboro Board of Trade for the Wurtsboro Mural Project.
So it's a wide range of folks that can be eligible, from organizations to individual artists. Let's talk about some of the eligibility requirements and who can apply. And are there any specific restrictions or requirements that people should be aware of?
Well, for the Individual Artist Fellowship, it's quite fortunate because if you are an individual artist, that's all you have to be. just an artist who is looking to get some, you know, extra funding for their practice. But for the community arts and arts education grant programs, you do need to be an organization, a nonprofit, or you need to have a fiscal sponsorship from a nonprofit. So if you are, let's say, an individual artist and you wanted to do a community arts project, you'd have to partner up with another nonprofit, such as like a library or, you know, for example, the Calicoon Business Association. And then they kind of, it becomes their project. They get the money and then they pay you. So that opens
like
up the world to
a sponsor type situation or a partner, as you said here. So, talk about these mini grants too. You've got mini grants this year. What are those and how can first time applicants benefit from those?
Mini grants are pretty excellent because they are a very nice entryway into the granting world. So if you've never applied for a grant before or pretty much if you just need like a nice easy way, and it's a lump sum of money, so the budget requirements are a lot easier. The application is a little bit streamlined, and it's a nice lump sum of money for a small project to just get your foot in the door to help, you know, I'll help you workshop your application. So it's a very nice, friendly, not intimidating. I mean, I don't think the other grant application is that intimidating, but you know, it's a nice lift.
And you're there to help too.
Yeah, and we have four. We have four of them last year. So we did two mini grants last year. This year we have four.
And 500. Are there any success stories from past grantees that you can share that, you know, had a significant impact on, you know, either the artist or the local arts community, or anything you can share there?
I don't know if I can say it. The Basic,
Basic Bitches. That's the name of the
bitches.
Band.
Oh, okay. Of course. they made an excellent, excellent music video, last year, with the Individual Artist Fellowship money. And then, Gorilla Toss was another band, that applied this past year for compositional arts. We have, let's see here. I think the Wurtsboro Board of Trade, like they are a story where they like applied for the mini grant, got the mini grant last year. Then this year they got, or I guess 2 years ago, they got the mini grant. Then this past year in 2025, they got like a larger community arts grant, and they've totally just like dived right into the world of our world of regranting here. And it's great to see that like that cycle that actually did work, you know, the mini grant to full funding. So, yeah, and also Parksville, New Memories, I'm trying to think, their project was the Halloween, I'm blanking on the name of it, but their Halloween program, they did that for a mini grant, and then this year they got funding for the Too Short to Suck Film Festival.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's great to see that there, you know, the organizations or communities that are starting off with, hey, maybe we should try this, and then, oh, this is great, and we're getting a, you know, a fuller grant or applying for a bigger grant.
It's Decrepit Ghouls, I remembered, which is going to be coming up.
Right. We're triggering now the new Halloween memories. Yes. And for the mystical world of regranting, there are some informational sessions for folks who may be, afraid of those, demystifying those.
So there are many, many opportunities this year to learn about the ins and outs of applying for this grant and just nice grant writing practices in general. So coming up on October 4th, Saturday, right at New Memories in Parksville, and that's right at noon too, it's 12 o'clock, we have our first informational session. It'll be pretty wonderful, and hopefully it'll be a nice warm day. It was a little bit cold last year when we went there. There's no heat.
There's no heat.
But this is earlier in the season to account for that. Then on Thursday, October 9th at 6 p.m. at the Black Library, we have our next informational session. Then Wednesday, October 15th at 6 p.m., we have a Zoom meeting. Please register in advance just so we know who's going to come to that one. But you can find the information for all of these online on our website. Saturday, October 18th at 2 p.m., right at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance on 37 Main Street, Narrowsburg, New York. And then Saturday, November 1st at 12 p.m. noon at the Liberty Museum and Arts Center. And then again on Wednesday, November 12th, 5 p.m., Zoom. Please register for that one as well.
Good news. National Weather Service says Saturday, October 4th, it will be sunny, nice, and warm with a high of 73.
I suspect it is. Yeah. I predicted it on the radio.
There
first,
you go. So. So for these sessions, these are really important for potential applicants to learn about the process. And as you said, it's not too cumbersome, but it is good to get in there and ask those questions you might have.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, there's a lot of like administrative things that we need. You know, like if you're a nonprofit, we need like the proof of nonprofit and some very documentation of that sort.
There's also a
budget that's required. But like writing the narrative, there's a certain way that you want to frame things for grant writing that speak to like the mission of the grant program, which is to provide quality arts programming in Sullivan County. And we want to really focus on that aspect of it, because a lot of projects might do a couple different things. But in the grant, you want to really highlight, you know, why is this grant right for that project? So just workshopping it, you know, reading it, looking it over, I'm happy to give feedback. And there's plenty of time until the December 3rd deadline to get in there.
And how can folks reach out to you for some personalized help or guidance?
Well, the best way to reach me is at my email, which is grants@DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. And you could also call DVAA, but it's definitely easier to email me because I will be out and about this month doing a lot of info sessions. But our phone number is 845-252-7576. And there's one more thing. I'm totally blanking on it now.
Well, you can also go to the website, DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org, to get all the information as well.
Yes, and then you can find my email address there.
That's Tanner Simon. He is the DVAA's grants coordinator and talking to us about the Arts for Sullivan grants that are assisting nonprofits and artists who wish to create arts, cultural, and heritage events or present year-round programming in Sullivan County. More information, again, at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org.
Thank you, Tanner. So much, Tim. I appreciate it.
All right. When we come back, culture reporter Valerie Manzi has the details about An Evening with Rod Serling. That's next on Radio Chatska.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. We go to El Salvador, the country with one of the strictest abortion laws in the world. And there we meet women who had stillborns or miscarriages and were incarcerated as a result.
If you have a miscarriage and go to the public system, they will call the police.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. And the creative force known behind this theme of this show, The Twilight Zone, is Rod Serling. He had an influence on American television and culture that went far beyond that. Born in Syracuse and raised in Binghamton, Serling also used his writing to challenge audiences with stories that blended science fiction, morality, and social commentary. Thursday at 7, the Rosendale Theater is hosting An Evening with Rod Serling to celebrate his remarkable life and career. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with programming member Bob Esposito about what audiences can expect from the event.
Good morning, folks, and welcome to Radio Catskill. Today's guest is Bob Esposito, and Bob Esposito is a programming committee member as well as a series producer of the Saturday Creature Feature Series at the Rosendale Theater. And you are involved in a very exciting event coming up Thursday, October 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Rosendale Theater. And it is an event celebrating the 66th anniversary of The Twilight Zone. And that premiered on October 2nd, 1959. Can you tell us about this?
Well, we were in touch. The theater was in touch with one of the members of the foundation, Tony Albarella, for one of our other series. We put this together as both of us grew up loving the Twilight Zone, being very familiar with Rod Serling and how he approached his television series. And as fans, we just thought it would be a fun night, and that many people would have many questions about Rod Serling and the series that he was involved in, and Planet of the Apes, which many people are not aware he wrote the screenplay for. So we put this together and have planned it for several months. And yes, it's coming up on October 2nd, and we're very much looking forward to it.
And what would the evening look like?
Well, there would be a surprise visitor waiting for people in the lobby, a Twilight Zone character, which we very much encourage people to take selfies with and enjoy. The character is 7.5 foot tall, so it should be fun. And then once the evening starts, Nicholas Parisi, the president of the foundation, and Tony Albarella, the vice president of the foundation, will be showing several hours of clips, photos, giving background information, and an extensive Q&A. We all know Rod Serling's work, but there is so many questions. We've put in an extended Q&A for the evening, so as many people as possible can get their questions answered.
And there's a lot of information. He was a very complex and creative man.
Oh, absolutely. As he became known in the industry and was given the chance to produce and create The Twilight Zone, he had a fight very often with prevailing ways of the period in Hollywood. Rod Serling injected much humanity in his characters, in his stories, in his introductions, in everything he did. And he didn't always jibe with what Hollywood was doing at the time or the direction that they were wanting to go. And he fought for it. And thankfully for us, he was successful in his battles in many respects. And today, multiple generations get to look back in a way that we are proud for him and what he was able to do, while we just enjoyed the shows and the films and the work that he did.
In my research, I came across a couple of interesting little nuggets of information of the kinds of issues that came up. For example, one of his stories, he used the word matches. And because the Ronson Lighter Company was sponsoring it, they didn't want the word matches. And when Ford was sponsoring one of his programs, they didn't want a reference to the Chrysler building.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, this was practice with the advertisers of the time. And if it made it into the final production of his show, then we can say he won the battle. You know, once again, we can be proud of him and entertained by him for giving the good fight in his battles.
Another little nugget I found was that in 1962, a young Robert Redford appeared in one of the Twilight Zone events.
Oh, absolutely. And as one goes through the Twilight Zone episodes, it's a who's who of actors who went on to much bigger things. Jack Klugman, Earl Holliman, William Shatner, Richard Kiel, Anne Francis. The list is endless. How many major actors of the period during and following the Twilight Zone did work on the Twilight Zone series?
I recognized a number of faces and then thought back to my own experience with the Twilight Zone and remembering some of those folks who then became quite famous. Another thing I didn't know was that he was awarded a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star during World War II.
As I've been looking into him more and more recently to prepare for the evening, I came across that also. And actually, I'm going to be learning quite a bit myself from the evening that I never knew about. His war service, his early writing career, the fact that Rod Serling wrote the screenplay for Planet of the Apes is relatively forgotten by many people, and we'll be bringing that out on the evening also, his work with Planet of the Apes. We would not have Planet of the Apes or any of its sequels if he didn't co-write the screenplay.
Well, to sum up, can you tell us again where and when this wonderful evening is going to be taking place?
Sure. This will be 7 p.m., October 2nd. This is a Thursday night at the Rosendale Theater, which is on Main Street in Rosendale, New York. And we have had very strong pre-sales for this, and it should be a very exciting night. We're delighted in the number of people who have responded to this event, and we look so much forward to the Foundation's presentation that evening, where we're all going to get to learn more than a few things that we never knew about Rod Serling and his work.
And for more information, folks can go to the Rosendale Theater, and that's with an RE.org. Well, thank you so much for putting this together, Bob.
Well, thank you, Valerie. Thank you for the opportunity to comment here. Thank you very much.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that report. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can find this show and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us.
Support for Radio Chatskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
With federal funding for public media eliminated, listeners all over this country are stepping up to support public radio. Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from All Things Considered.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe from Weekend Edition. We're here to share a little of what people are saying. Kyle in Brooklyn says, I'm skipping two lattes a month to keep Steve Inskeep in my ear each morning. We see you and thank you, Kyle.
Farouk in El Paso, Texas says, public radio is one of the key bloodlines of this country, keeping communities connected. Thank you, Farouk.
And Diane in Juneau, Alaska says, I'm so sorry this day has come. You have my support as long as I am able. Thanks, Diane.
If you have already made your gift to the station, or if you're a sustaining donor, seriously, thank you.
If not, please join the movement to protect public radio today and tell us why you're stepping up.
Here's how to donate, and thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Today's forecast, sunshine and a few afternoon clouds, very warm, a high 76 and a bit breezy too. Tonight, clear skies, a low near 40. Tomorrow, mainly sunny with a high around 65, so a little bit cooler, but then warming back up by the end of the week, looking at 75 again for Sunday. On Point is next.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from
Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming online at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.